The last agenda item is the report from the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, ICAT. Behind tab number one, there's several documents. We'll be discussing Atlantic bluefin tuna and northern swordfish issues, as discussed at the November 2010 ICAT meeting. I'll turn it over to Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As John mentioned, there are several documents, and I added one because by mistake, I don't know how it happened, but by mistake, the big eye tuna section was added instead of the swordfish, so you have the correct one now anyway. We're not concerned with big eye tuna. There have been a number of questions that have been brought up within the council about the reason for our involvement in ICAT and where it comes from and how the council's involved and does this come out of our budget, those kinds of questions. I've been asked that by a number of people on the council. And I'd like to just very quickly go through that. ICAT is the agency the group which manages high seas fisheries on high seas, meaning outside of national boundaries, for 30 different species, roughly 30 different species of tunas, swordfish, billfish, and sharks. It was formed in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in 1969, operates under the aegis of the United Nations. U.S. is one of the original members. Headquarters is in Madrid, Spain. And I'm not going to get any further into it than that, but that's the origin of ICAT. It's been around a long time. The involvement of the councils began with the American Tunas Convention Act of 1975, and the ATCA was the organic act that brought the United States into compliance with the ICAT dictates. And, again, it's a complicated piece of legislation, but in terms of the logistics, what it did was it identified three commissioners and how they would be chosen, three commissioners to ICAT, U.S. commissioners, one of which would be a relatively high-ranking member of the whatever the current administration was, and the other two would be one from the generally accepted recreational sphere and the other from the commercial sphere. These are the commissioners who are authorized to actually do the direct negotiations for the country. Most of our regional fishery management organizations are organized along that general pattern. NAFO is organized the same way. They are also, part of that is also an advisory panel or an advisory committee. The advisory committee is a little different than the APs and ACs that we have with the state and regional councils. The council representation in that advisory panel is dictated in the American Tunas Convention Act, where it says there is established an advisory committee which shall be composed of, and then it identifies individuals that can be put in. And then there are obligatory seats for the chairman or the designees of the New England, Mid-Atlantic, South Atlantic, Caribbean, and Gulf Fishery Management Councils established under Section 302A of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. And it goes on to say that the advisory committee shall attend all non-executive meetings of the United States commissioners, and at such meetings shall be given opportunity to examine and to be heard on all proposed programs of investigation, reports, recommendations, and regulations of the commission. This is from the law, the actual act. And it goes on to say that the secretary shall provide to the advisory committee in a timely manner such administrative and technical support services as are necessary for the effective functioning of the committee. The Secretary and the Secretary of State shall furnish the Advisory Committee with relevant information concerning fisheries and international fishery agreements. So it's ensconced in law, the input of the councils. We have a direct say in the management of HMS species and of ICAT proceedings. And it's through this structure that was set up in 1975. Are there any questions or comments on that before I go on? It's pretty straightforward. Also, one other thing I meant to mention is that the councils are reimbursed for the expenses of the council member that represents the council. I don't know the logistics of how that works, but I know that that's part of the arrangement. And the next thing I'd like to do is to to tell you what my job was when I went to Paris this year as part of the U.S. delegation representing the councils. The charge was given by this council in October of 2008, October 15th, 2008, in a letter that went to Dr. Lent. You people may remember the votes that we took at the council. There were three directives that were given to me directly, actually, and we're in a letter that went to Dr. Lent, and it's in here as number five in the packet. And the one I'd like to draw your attention to is the first bullet. This was part of a motion that was proposed by Dave Gaethel and was seconded by Rodney Avila and passed with a substantial margin. I don't have the margin in front of me, but it was a substantial margin. That science be followed in setting ICAT member quotas in 2009. That was specific instructions of the following year. And that's the last set of instructions I have, and that's the instructions that I took with me to Paris, and that we would follow the science. We were required to by law anyway, and it was the right thing to do. We had been involved, if you remember, in a discussion of tax and what tax we should support, and Dave Gaethel, quite rightly, ended the discussion by saying, this is ridiculous. This has to be determined by people who know what they're talking about, and our stance is that the science be followed. And that was the directive, and I want to point that out because that became a highly contentious issue in this year's meeting, just what the science actually did say. And I spent a lot of time. I took 100 pages of notes and transcriptions, including all of the stuff on science. Very briefly, what came out of the meeting was that it was important to the United States. A lot comes out of the meeting. Chris Rogers made considerable progress in his last term with the Compliance Committee, and we now have a compliance structure for ICAT, which is truly effective, and it's reached the point now where our 21,000 tons or so of illegally caught fish has been reduced to the point where it's not statistically significant and can't even be properly measured. So we've had a considerable change over the last 3 years, and that's largely the result of the incredible work that Chris Rogers did as head of that committee. So we have a way of identifying infractions and a set of procedures that ICAT can take to reduce that problem. The other thing that happened this year along those same lines is that the U.S. proposed to establish binding minimum standards for scientific observer programs, and those programs will, in fact, improve the data collection in the future and fisheries monitoring. So that was another, what I consider to be an important achievement of this year's meeting. There was also one that was important to the U.S., and that was a binding measure to address sea turtle bycatch, because we did have an issue, particularly between the country to the north of us and the U.S. as far as sea turtles and the swordfish. So that we now have a binding measure to address that, and that should go a long way to helping the U.S. fishermen in terms of the turtle. I wasn't involved with that one, but I have the information on it if anybody's interested in it afterwards. And then the two substantive issues of quotas. The first one, the one that was the easiest to arrive at in some ways, although it was delicate, is North Atlantic swordfish. If you recall, we had a problem with swordfish in that the U.S. sword fishermen have for several years now not been catching their quota. That, unfortunately, under the rules of the game, that opens us up to quota theft. And this year, we did successfully defend our quota against serious efforts to steal it, but it's a mixed victory, and I'll go into that when I talk about swordfish in a little while. We're going to have more problems in the future with swordfish, but at least for the moment, our quota amount is intact for one more year, and we need to do all we can to move people into U.S. fishermen into that fishery. We need to be taking more of that quota, and it's available to us, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And then the last thing was, and it literally was the last thing, this really was in the 10 days of 14-plus hour days, at the last minute, there was an agreement arrived at for bluefin tuna that basically the important thing in terms of what happened is that there was a quota reduction in both the eastern and western stocks. It's not a whole lot. The eastern stock was reduced by 4% and the western stock by 3%. So that's in general what happened. What I'd like to do now is to go on to the swordfish situation, and I'll be as brief as I can with this. I'd like you to refer you to page 122 on the swordfish document. It's document number 3, page 122. And I'd like to look at the first paragraph where it says, fishing mortality has been below FMSY since 2005. The results suggest that there is a greater than 50% probability that the stock is at or above BMSY, and thus the Commission's rebuilding objective has been achieved. However, it is important to note that since 2003, the catches have been below the tax, greatly increasing the chances for a fast recovery. This is an important point that we have to bear in mind, because that portion of the tax that was below, or that portion of the catch that was below the tax, was entirely the result of the U.S. shortfall in catch. And so we can say with complete confidence that the U.S. quota shortfall is what resulted in the rapid recovery of the swordfish. And that I think is going to become it's been an important point in the negotiations, and I think it will continue to be so. And then further down it says, attack of 13,000 tons would provide approximately a 75% probability of maintaining the stock at a level consistent with the convention objective over the next decade. And on the following page on the bottom of the North Atlantic, it says, consistent with the goal of the Commission's swordfish rebuilding plan, in order to maintain the North Atlantic swordfish stock at a level that could produce MSY with greater than 50% probability, the committee recommended reducing catch limits allowed by Rec 06-02, which was 15,245 tons, to no more than 13,700 tons, which reflects the best estimate of maximum yield that could be harvested from the population under existing environmental and fishery commissions. Now, I wanted to point that out because that will give you a little background to the kind of really weird negotiations that took place. If you turn to page 125, there is a summary of the Atlantic swordfish and the North Atlantic swordfish. The MSY is 13,730 tons with the confidence limits of 13,020 to 14,182. The current TAC, 2009 TAC, was 14,000. The TAC as agreed on this year was 13,700. And the last assessment was not this year. It was last year, and the next assessment will be in 2012. Now, if you move on to page 129, there's a graphic. I know that the colors didn't come out in the one that you have, but you can see on the top graphic, the TAC is indicated by the zigzag dark line, and the shortfall is the white area beneath it, and that's entirely the U.S. Shortfall. So and then again, if we move to page 135, when we look at the numbers for B over BMSY, you see that 13,000 results in a slow increase beyond B over BMSY equals 1. So as long as we are within that 13,700 range, then we're safe as far as the fishery is concerned biologically. Now, if you would move to 10-02, this is what actually happened. And it's really, I guess you'd call it funny numbers, or funny math. To ensure the conservation of North Atlantic swordfish with the goal of maintaining BMSY with greater than 50% probability, for this purpose, a total allowable catch of 13,700 tons shall be set for 2011. Now, if you look at the catch limits for all the countries, it adds up to 15,345. What happened here was that the four major countries make up the majority of it, and adding in Morocco, that gets you to the 13,700. The other countries below there to make it long story short, it's a little different with each country, but basically these are the ones that wanted to raid our quota. So they had been fishing in the amounts that you see here. These were their actual catches on our shortfall, and they want to convert that to permanent quota. We managed to fend that off. What we have is we've maintained our 3,907 metric ton quota and our percentage of the 13,700, but it's not the same percentage when you add the rest of it together. These other countries have been guaranteed, or not guaranteed, but they have this target catch for the next 2 years. This is a one-year rollover, basically, and we're going to be going back to ICAT next year to try to move it on for more years. The attempt was to have a multi-year agreement that would take us until the 2012 complete analysis of assessment, rather, of the northern swordfish. So that's what happened. The U.S. maintained its number, and it's going to be tricky in the future. This year we had a lot of tools to maintain that quota. These negotiations involve all kinds of things, and the more things you have in the fire at once, the better you come out usually. Next year we really don't have anything. Bluefin tuna is not up next year. The southern tunas, the tropical tunas, are going to be emphasized next year along with continuing the swordfish. So I'm not secure about the future. All I can say right now is that the agreement for swordfish for this year was an adequate agreement. It maintains our quota. It appears to maintain our quota share, but there's more than one way of looking at the numbers, and I would basically call it funny math. So that's it for the swordfish. Any comments or questions on that before I move on, because I've got to get into the 900-pound gorilla here. Okay, the 900-pound gorilla, of course, is bluefin tuna. And bluefin tuna dominated everybody's thoughts for the entire time at ICAT. It resulted in some of the most bizarre carryings on that I've ever seen. And we had people running around with cars with big giant bluefin tunas on the top. We had people that were slapping signs on automobiles and these huge posters that they were slapping on windows, and there was even an assault or two, and it was a mess. And that was based upon what I would call buffoonery on the part of the environmental NGOs, or not all of them, but at least the ones that acted like buffoons. And it was based upon their misrepresentation of science. And that's what's driving the endangered species listing right now. And I don't want to go any further with this because my report is not about the ESL listing. It's not about the ESL proposal. I don't want to entertain any questions or comments about that because that wasn't part of the Paris proceedings, and I don't want to make it part of this one. And we also had some of the NGOs from the other side that misinterpreted some of the science and unfortunately seemed to be involved in conspiracies. I don't want to deal with that either. There were no conspiracies, and nobody is involved with endangered species listing. These are all different things. I want to stick completely with the science, completely with what actually occurred. The SCRS conducted a comprehensive assessment of bluefin tuna in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean in 2010. This was the first comprehensive assessment in 2 years, and it involved some serious changes. And I'd like to refer you to the ICAT report, page 76. And on the top, it says the SCRS is the science people. The SCRS implemented a new growth curve for Western stock that was derived from advanced analytical techniques. The adoption of the new growth curve that is nearly identical to that for the Eastern stock has resulted in significant changes to some of the benchmarks for the Western stock and consequently the management advice. This was a complication that I'd like to walk us through because it was significant to the outcome of the bluefin tuna and is significant to what we decide to do for the Western stock, not just this year, but in the future. There's some very serious decisions that have to be made here. If you turn to page 81, before I do that, I'd like to read you something that I ran across in this February issue of the National Fisherman and Fishing Back When, 50 years ago, 1961. Using Japanese long lines in an experimental fishery, a Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution team finds bluefin tuna for the taking, opening the way to year-round fishing. This is 1961. The best catches come between Hudson Canyon and the Great South Channel on the 1,000-fathom line. That's an enormous stretch of ocean. And I'd like to point out that I was 18 years old at the time, and I can tell you that there were bluefin tuna all over Block Island, and east of Block Island, south of Block Island, the smaller fish, and that Block Island Sound was absolutely awash with giant tuna at that time, and you could find them everywhere. It was a whole different ball game than what we see today. And I'd like to direct you to the top of page 81. The total catch for the West Atlantic peaked at 18,671 tons in 1964. This is just 3 years after the fishery was discovered. There were a massive number of tuna seiners brought from the West Coast to take advantage of this fishery, and they really did it. And this was mostly due to the Japanese longline fishery for large fish off Brazil and the U.S. purse seine fishery for juvenile fish. The U.S. purse seine fishery at that time amounted to about 12,000 tons, a little over 12,000 tons. Catches dropped sharply thereafter with the collapse of the bluefin tuna bycatch longline fishery off Brazil and decline in purse seine catches, but increased again to average over 5,000 tons in the 1970s due to the expansion of the Japanese longline fleet into the Northwest Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico. I can remember flying over that fleet 200 to 300 miles offshore, 400 miles offshore, and there'd be literally hundreds of these big white Japanese boats in there working those fish. And the result of that was that the bluefin tuna collapsed, and we have a complete change in the biology of the fish that centers on the year 1974. Okay, moving down, page 81. The catch rates of juvenile bluefin tuna in the U.S. rod and reel fishery fluctuate with little apparent long-term trend, but exhibit a pattern that is consistent with the strong year class estimated for 2003. That's an important point, and I just want to bring that up a little later. I'm going to connect that to something a little further along. And it also says, whereas the Gulf of Mexico larval survey continues to fluctuate around the low levels observed since the 1980s. So what we have here is a situation of juvenile collapse. Well, the fishery collapsed, and the juvenile situation changed completely. The new assessment below there, where it says bluefin tuna west, state of the stock. A new assessment was conducted this year, including information through 2009. And it mentions the influential change of the new growth curve, which assigns fish above 120 centimeters to older ages than did the previous growth curve. As a result, the base model estimates lower fishing mortality rates and higher biomasses for spawners. So we do have more spawners. There's no question we have more spawners than we used to have. Also less potential in terms of the maximum sustainable yield, another important point. The trends estimated during the 2010 assessment are consistent with previous analyses in that the spawning stock biomass declined steadily from 1970 to 1992 and has since fluctuated between 21% and 29% of the 1970 level. That's where we are. In recent years, however, there appears to have been a gradual increase in SSP from the low of 21% in 2003 to an estimated 29% in 2009. That increase is largely the result of two things. One is the 2003 year class, and the second is the U.S. fishery not catching its quota during that period of time. That resulted, as I've got another paper here that gives the biology of that resulted in the increase in biomass that we currently see. Okay, estimates of recruitment were very high in the early 1970s. Here we're getting to the crux of the problem with the bluefin tuna. And additional analyses involving longer catch and index series suggest that recruitment was also high during the 1960s. Since 1977, recruitment has varied from year to year without trend, with the exception of a strong year class in 2003. The 2003 year class is estimated to be the largest since 1974, but not quite as large as those prior to 1974. The year 2003 class is expected to begin to contribute to an increase in spawning biomass after several years. That 2003 class is just now beginning to enter, recruit into the spawning stock biomass just now. The committee expressed concern that the year class estimates subsequent to 2003, while less reliable, are the lowest on record. And I mention that because there have been isolated instances of large numbers of later year classes seen, but they don't cover a large area. And it's important to note that the recreational cache reflects that. It reflects the large 2003 year class, but also reflects the paucity of fish after that. And I know that in my waters, the school fishery has been very bad over the last few years. Okay, moving down, bluefin tuna west outlook. Future recruitment, and I want to stress that this says future recruitment, and this is under the new assessment, the 2010 assessment. Let me look at the first sentence first. A medium-term 10-year outlook evaluation of changes in spawning stock size and yield over the remaining rebuilding period under various management options was conducted. Now, this was not a retrospective look, and this is what a lot of people did not understand when they read this. This is an evaluation of future recruitment. It was assumed to fluctuate around two alternative scenarios. One, average levels observed for 1976 to 2006, 85,000 recruits, is a low recruitment scenario. And two, levels that increase as the stock rebuilds, MSY level of 270,000 recruits, the high recruitment scenario. The committee has no strong evidence to favor either scenario over the other and notes that both are reasonable but not extreme, lower and upper limits. They're not alternatives. It says right here they are lower and upper bounds on rebuilding potential. Now, I looked into that in some depth, and I spoke with the SERS people in Paris, and what we have here is a situation that was described by Brian Rothschild very well, actually, in his book, The Dynamics of Marine Fish Populations. And he calls this the recruitment stock paradox. Lose my voice. And devotes quite a bit of the book to the recruitment stock paradox. And I'd like to read just one thing that Brian Rothschild wrote about this situation. He said, the best strategy for managing a collapsed stock depends on whether the stock has an inherent capability of increasing or whether fishing or other causes have for some reason generated a permanent or semi-permanent depression in recruitment success. If the stock has an inherent capability of increasing, then the costs and benefits of a moratorium on fishing could be evaluated. But if the stock has lost this inherent capacity, it would be necessary to adjust long-run fishing effort to a much reduced stock level. Thus, the success or failure of a stock rebuilding strategy depends to a large extent on whether the stock has retained or lost its inherent capability of increasing to pre-collapse levels. This observation again focuses on the recruitment problem and the identification of the conditions associated with good recruitment and poor recruitment. What we have here is a situation where we have been assuming over the last 3 decades that this collapsed stock has permanently lost its ability to produce a high recruitment scenario, and the evidence up to now has demonstrated that. The 2003 year class, on the other hand, has also demonstrated that with bluefin tuna, as the recovery begins, that it will recover its ability to have high recruitment. We have that evidence with 2003. That was something that was not seen since 2004, and that's an important distinction in where this went in Paris. Some of the available fishery indicators, as well as the current assessment, suggest the spawning biomass of western bluefin tuna may be slowly rebuilding. That, in fact, is occurring. So it also says the strong 2003 year class has contributed to stock productivity such that biomass has been increasing in recent years. That simply says that we've made a lot of fish in 2003, so we got a lot of fish left. Okay. In terms of probabilities, what they say is that Despite the large uncertainty about long-term future productivity, because we've only got the one good year class right now, under either recruitment scenario, whether high or low, the current catches, which are the 1,800 tons that we operated on in 2009, or 2010 rather, should allow the biomass to continue to increase. Also, catches in excess of 2,500 ton will prevent the possibility of the 2003 year class elevating the productivity potential of the stock in the future. In other words, if we go much higher, and the SCRS representative was asked this specifically, if we go much higher than the 1,800 tons, then we really do constrain the ability of that 2003 year class to continue to contribute to the long-term stability of the stock. And it says below, under recommendations, the commission may wish to protect the 2003 year class until it reaches maturity and can contribute to spawning. Maintaining catch at current levels may offer some protection. And I've read in some of the press releases that, oh, that'll give them protection. All it says is, and this is right out of the SCRS report, it may offer some protection. So what we have here basically is a situation where we've got a recovering stock and we really need to protect that year class to further increase the breeding stock and to see if we can once again recover the high recruitment that we had up until the early 1970s. Now, if you turn to page 84, we see the results of that. If we continue to assume the low potential recruitment, what that says is, first of all, that the relative spawning stock biomass now is 1.1 relative, B over BMSY. But it also says that the long-term productivity is low and gives us a maximum sustainable yield of just 2,585 tons. So if we accept that, the low recruitment in the future, then we wind up with an MSY of 2,585 tons on a long range, of which the U.S. would get a small percentage of that. To me, that seems like a permanently constrained fishery. If we get to the high yield, on the other hand, I asked Jerry in particular, the head of the SCRS, about just this question, and he said that the problem with the low recruitment scenario is that it explains the fishery back to 74 and is useless before 74 because we have that break in the ability of the stock to recover its juvenile recruitment. Now, if we get the stock up to the high potential recruitment, in other words, the kind of recruitment that we saw before 74, then that means that right now the relative spawning stock biomass is 0.15. We've got work to do. But it gives us a maximum sustainable yield of 6,329 tons. And we're talking about well over twice the maximum sustainable yield that we get if we continue with the low recruitment scenario. So where's the truth in this? Well, if we look at the Kobe matrix on page 93, and right here I'm going to recommend the copy that you have didn't retain the colors and is very dark. We have a handout that we got earlier this morning from the American Bluefin Tuna Association. And if you look at the last page, you have a far better copy of the Kobe matrices, and that's well worth looking at. The management goal for ICAT right now is to achieve rebuild by 2019 for the Western stock with at least a 50% probability. If we take the low recruitment scenario, then we're in fine shape. But what that indicates is that we are seeing all we're going to get. If we take the high recruitment scenario, this is the one that environmentalists and the people who want to declare the fish an endangered species, then we see that we can't get there before 2019, even with no catch whatsoever. Well, what the SERS recommendation was since this was not alternatives, but two ends of a spectrum, they said that we have the lower limit and the upper limit that represent our confidence limits, and that the procedure that should be followed, or that is normally followed, he didn't say should, he said they don't recommend it that way. He said the procedure that would be followed in science would be to take the geometric mean, and that would be where you'd have the highest probability of being correct. The geometric mean is at the bottom, the combined recruitment scenarios. And the problem here is that if we look at 50%, we have to go to 750 metric tons. That's if we want to reach the 2019 goal. That's certainly not necessary to collapse any fishery to that extent, in light of the fact that the SERS also said that maintaining the 1800 would result in a continuing increase in the biomass. It also said we wouldn't reach the goal by 2019, but that we would make continuous progress. So this was the crux of the debate that occurred in the science. And the scientific advice only tells us in ICAT what will happen if we take these different alternatives. The alternative that was finally selected was a result of primarily of negotiations between the United States, the European Union, Japan, and Canada. Of the three, the official stances of the three countries was that we need a reduction, and only Canada wanted an increase. That's by the stated objectives of each country. When all the fur flew and the settlement was finally reached, they went to the combined recruitment scenario, 1,750 metric tons, which gives us a 47.9% chance of reaching the objective in 2019. That's fundamentally what happened. Now, we can argue rather what was right and what was wrong, but that's what basically happened. The last thing I want to show you is on page 98. On page 98, if you look at the top, on all of these, in fact, you can see the bump provided by 2003. And the assumption here is there won't be any other bumps. I'm not at all convinced that that's a safe assumption. If we get more bumps, then we're in a position of increasing the TAC considerably over the next few years. But that's the decision that was made, and that was how ICAT ended. We have 750 metric tons instead of the 1,800 that we had last year, and it was based upon using the combined recruitment scenarios as the scientist in SERS said was the most appropriate thing to do. So last thing I want to just say is that the rebuilding programs are in under 10-3 in session number 4. So if you want to take a look at that, it's there in some detail. So that concludes it. Any questions, comments?
Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? Rip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. Dave, you mentioned that the IUU fishing reduction had been very successful. Did they go into any detail on how that was accomplished and how they monitor that?
Okay, if I said IUU, I don't remember saying IUU. I misstated because it wasn't the IUU. The IUU fisheries are a different thing, and it's really impossible to say to what extent there are a problem, but the IUU problem with bluefin seems to be reduced. There is some, I don't want to get into specific countries here because I don't have the evidence in front of me, but there's at least one country that's transshipping tuna across this country and selling them at a different ocean. So, we have all of those problems, but IUU is a different thing. What I was referring to is noncompliance with the contracting countries. And almost all of the European countries have engaged in noncompliance. It's really almost a pulse fishing situation. It seems that the European countries had decided over the past few years that the bluefin tuna fishery was going to be liquidated, that somebody was going to destroy it because there was no really effective way of controlling the illegal catch among the countries who were part of ICAT, countries who were wildly overfishing their quotas. So the European countries began doing the same, and France and Spain were wildly overfishing their quotas to the extent of 20 to 25,000 tons in a year. That was fish that was going into the legitimate markets, but not doing it legitimately. It's like selling fish from a recreational boat at the dock. It's not legal, but it does go into the economy. So that was the part that was reduced, and that made up the majority of the illegal fishing was of that nature rather than the IUU fishing. The IUU fishing is being addressed primarily through keeping a registry of boardings by various countries of vessels that are fishing that don't belong there, they have port state requirements. They can't offload. They can't take on fuel. They can't come into U.S. ports except in the direst emergency that involves safety of the vessel, that kind of thing. So that's how IUU is basically controlled. It's never going to be perfect. But the way it is now, the illegal catches at least can be tracked through the markets, and that's how it's tracked. And the markets at this point do not reveal any significant or even particularly measurable illegal catches entering the legitimate markets at this time.
Anything further for Dave? Well, thank you, Dave. Rich?
Thank you, Chairman John. Long time no see. With a lot of faces here, it's good to see a lot of you again. First, to Rip's point, and Dave gave a very adequate answer, but about 3 years ago, Rich Ruay, representing American Bluefin Tuna Association, and only the American Bluefin Tuna Association today. But IUU has been the focus. Illegal, unreported, unregulated catches has been a thorn in ICAT's side, as most people know, since the beginning of ICAT. Either people didn't join it, fishing countries didn't join it, or they joined it and they ignored the rules and regulations and just fished to their heart's content. ICAT recognizes Taiwan, for example, as a major IUU fishing country with misreporting of catches and the government actually supporting their industry. Japan recognized it, and the United States recognized it for a long time. About 3 years ago, ABTA and Blue Water joined up, and we worked to change the Magnuson Act to provide the U.S. government with more authority to pursue through ICAT uncovering the sources of IUU fishing, and as Dave says, it's largely not really an at-sea enforcement mechanism. It's largely a data mining and data tracking, statistical documents that have to be filled out. That's allowed us to hone in on comparing the market data with the catch data submitted to ICAT. And then tracking back to the source of the offending country and penalize them. And it's done through two committees at ICAT. And the bottom line, to make it real simple, is there's been a great improvement. The most recent round was just issue of identifying countries. It's a very detailed process that has to take place in order to sanction a country that continues to fish outside of the rules of ICAT. But the most recent round has raised a flurry of attention because the United States identified Italy. And Italy is a member of the European community, so it's kind of stepping on the toes of a major league player within ICAT to do that, and the U.S. is probably receiving substantial pressure for doing so. But and I did want to touch on the swordfish. Dave's report was pretty accurate on that. We dodged a bullet this year. Next year is going to be a very hectic swordfish fishing year, no doubt about it. We won, if you will, at ICAT on swordfish this year by delaying a year, simply by putting some alternatives out there for how we're going to share our large percentage share, about 30% of the quota, with the underdeveloped countries. and other countries demanding so much that the waters got so muddied and people were focused on bluefin. The chairman of Panel 4, which is a swordfish panel, basically gave up and said all countries will come to the table next year, 2011, with a development plan showing how they're going to use this swordfish quota that they're demanding from the haves, if you will, the United States, European Community, Canada, and Japan are the haves when it comes. And a lot of other countries are just trying to get swordfish quota right now to be able to transfer it, barter it, trade it off. They really don't have fisheries, and that's not consistent with the allocation policy that was developed by ICAT. So I just wanted to say that about swordfish. And the stock is rebuilt and continuing to rebuild. It's the BMSY now is 1.5 of the level it produces maximum sustainable yield, so it's actually overbuilt. And because of our continuing under catches, the size structure of swordfish, we should be reading more and more about it in the Sport Fishing magazine, the number of markers that the anglers are going to be encountering, including in the deep water dropping fisheries that some of the very clever anglers are now developing in St. Croix in Florida, in the Gulf of Mexico, and elsewhere. On today's report on tuna, when I first saw his article, Parisian Tuna Follies, I was amused with the title and enjoyed my starting to read it, and I assumed that he meant by follies when I think of follies, I think of circus atmosphere. And when you first go into an ICAT plenary meeting, you certainly have a circus atmosphere. You can multiply. You've got five states represented here with basically two members or three members at ICAT. You've got 47 countries that get three members around the table, and you've always got a couple of hundred NGOs in the back of the room. And the meeting starts off, everybody's full of brim and firestone, ready to rock and roll, and the first thing they do is make announcements of who's there and then take a 20-minute coffee break to deflate everybody's egos and try to get things under control. I wanted to say Dave's history lesson, if you will, on the beginning of the bluefin tuna wasn't quite accurate. It wasn't a massive, based on the 1958 Bureau of Commercial Fisheries study by Pete Wilson and others showing those long-line cruise results, showing commercial concentrations of tuna offshore. That did get the attention of some West Coast seiners and one West Coast seiner. And I saw Paul Diodati in the office. He knows him very well. He talks to him all the time. If he's still here, Mr. Ingrande would correct you on that one, Dave, that he alone came with his pilot through the Panama Canal and started the fishery and then was joined by several other purse seine boats here. And it was the Canadian super seiners that were coming through the canal returning from the Western Pacific yellowfin tuna fishery to bring yellowfin to the canneries in Canada that were the fleets that were the biggest. They were 1,000-tonners compared to these little 200-ton purse seine boats. We eventually evolved into a fleet of about five boats that were grandfathered into it. And it was primarily an inshore cannery fishery competing for skipjack, yellowfin, tuna, and bluefin at the time. And those catches were very high in the 1960s because they were fishing upon a relatively underexploited resource at that time, both in the Western Atlantic and in the Eastern, most importantly in the Eastern Atlantic and Mediterranean. And we were getting a lot of sustainability of our catches, large catches, from the low level of catches, 10,000 tons and under, sometimes maybe approaching 15,000 tons in the Mediterranean and Eastern Atlantic. So anyways, that just tries to put that in perspective. Where we found some serious disagreement with Dave was in his conclusions one is on his interpretations of the science, number two, and he was really pretty detailed, and it's really not quite as complex as I think it seems right now, the way it's been left. But also in his suggestions that NGOs misrepresented and were acting mendacious. And I did appreciate the term mendacious. It caused me to go to Webster's to look it up because I forgot that it really means lying. And I can assure you, I can't speak for the ENGOs, but for the NGOs, ABTA had put on the record two documents, one a pre-ICAT meeting asking for what we wanted in terms of objectives, and a post-meeting report, and both of them contained no lies, no misrepresentation of the science, and no dishonesty. We had advanced copies of the stock assessment before it was even approved, so we had plenty of time to bring ourselves up, and when it was first released publicly, we were overjoyed at the findings in the Western Atlantic that the approach that had been used by the United States since 1998, first introduced by Raleigh Schmitten, then seconded by Bill Hogarth from in 2002, 2004, 2006, and taken over by Dr. Rebecca Lent and continued, was to use the two-line low recruitment strategy as the objective for rebuilding the resource. And when we got the report, it was very clear that the report made it clear that we had achieved that objective, the target we had been shooting for all that time. The reason why the U.S. and the Western quota went from 2,700 metric tons in 1997 to 1998 down to 2,500 tons at the beginning of the program, and then we suffered further cuts to 2,500 tons, 2,200 tons, down to 1,900 tons, and then finally 1,800 metric tons. 1,800 metric tons put the U.S. in a situation where Rebecca could go home and legitimately say that we were consistent with the Magnuson Act, that we were no longer overfishing Western Atlantic bluefin tuna. And that was vindicated by the SCRS report, that at that level of catch in the Western Atlantic, we were no longer overfishing. The stock remained overfished. But subsequent to that, with the change in the age and growth curve, in the report, it made it very clear that, in fact, indeed, the biomass in 2010, according to the stock assessment, was at BSMSY. In fact, it was above BMSY at that 2585 metric ton level. And we disagree with the suggestion that it can't grow any further. The report makes it very clear that at 1,800 tons and higher levels, you'll continue to rebuild the biomass, and that's where the 2,000 people need to remember. The 2003 year class that we're trying to protect was spawned, which was a very good year class, was spawned under the higher quotas of 2,500 metric tons back in 2003. Sorry, that was spawned from year classes that were born when catch levels were considerably higher. In fact, 2660 was when that year class was probably spawned. So it doesn't lock us in to 2585 as the maximum sustainable yield, but what it does is it gives you great pleasure to know that your sacrifices have been achieved, and the group that we felt has not dealt with us very honestly in this whole process is NOAA. Number one, they pretty much ignored and you did a good job explaining the process of the ICAT Advisory Committee. You'll recall when we were in the November or October meeting, I'm sorry, of the ICAT Advisory Committee, or maybe it was early November, it was pretty much, as Chairman John Graves always does at the end of any speech, he sort of does an informal poll around the room trying to figure out if there's a consensus or not on the on what the committee is going to recommend. And there's rarely a unanimity, but there's pretty most of the times there's a majority. And I think the majority in that room clearly were for 1,800 metric tons or the modest increase that American Bluefin Tuna Association was pushing for, a small reward for fishermen for reaching the bar. We achieved the bar, yet we still wanted to take a precautionary approach in moving forward. Unlike the Canadians that wanted to go all the way to 2585, we wanted to be a little bit safer than that. And NOAA pretty much ignored the ICAT Advisory Committee recommendation and, in fact, didn't do what the council asked for, which was follow the science, and didn't do what they promised us they would do when the new administration and the new leadership first came in. They promised us science-based management. And when you look at and they insisted upon, for example, the United States and Japan were very big in developing that COBE matrix, which is now spread to a lot of international fora, using probabilities to ascertain the likelihood of your rebuilding success. And that's what this document is all about, was that it was a COBE matrix. And you were correct in pointing out that at the 1,800 metric ton level, we had about a 95.8% chance of rebuilding, far above the 50% that's required in the rebuilding plan, of maintaining BMSY above the level that is required. At the small marginal increase that U.S. fishermen were asking for to keep our fishery going of 2250, we had an 86% probability, still substantially above the 50% requirement. And at full MSY, as pointed out by the Canadians, 2585 would still provide you with a 78.2%. So it was NOAA that wasn't following the science. We followed the science, and that was the objective. We got no explanation for why all of a sudden, with a change in leadership, there would be a reversal of 12 years of the U.S. objective for following the two-line approach, which also gave you the opportunity at any given time when good year classes come around to protect them. And we heard loud and clear from Dr. Clay Porch and others that 1,800 metric tons and even some quota levels higher than that will provide protection to the 2003 year class. And we beg to differ after traveling around the country to Pascagoula, Mississippi, and New Bern, North Carolina, or Portland, Maine. At these ESA hearings, we've heard loud and clear from fishermen that there's plenty of strong year classes that are coming in behind that 2003 year class. In New Bern just the other night, North Carolina, we heard a fisherman say that he got up and testified that he fished from the Canadian border to south of North Carolina, and his smallest fish he was catching was 20-pounders all the way up to 700-pound fish. We heard him in Portland, Maine, the Saco Bay Tackle Shop, saying that small 25 to 40-pound bluefin were being confused for bluefish, and the anglers were getting stripped of their gear, and it was wonderful for him. They were coming into him and getting all spooled up to go back out fishing for tuna with the proper gear. And as you can see from the angling category catches in recent years, there's a number of strong year classes that are leading to them fairly grossly exceeding their 285 metric ton quota by more than double. So we aren't the ones that are not following the science. We followed it quite nicely, and as soon as we got to where we were told we needed to get, all of a sudden the bar gets raised with no explanation of why we're going after that. And then there's just a couple more points that I want to make. I know I'm taking a lot of time, and I'll try to make this one fast. But there were a few other things that are precedent-setting that took place by NOAA that really upset a lot of us. I've been involved for 20 years in the process, and protocol was broken on a number of occasions. The first was probably minor, closing off the U.S. delegation room, and leadership's first meeting in Paris was with the NGOs to explain what the U.S. objectives were before she met with the U.S. delegation to explain the same. Very unusual. And by the way, my sources of information, I have a lot of colleagues from Malta, Japan, and Canada. 15 minutes after these meetings take place, I get phone calls, regardless of the time of day, telling me what just transpired in the room. And the United States put in the meeting room with the Canadian delegation a proposal to reduce the West Atlantic quota to 1,350 metric tons based upon what science we still have yet to go. But worse than that, the chairman of SCRS, who's currently a United States citizen, Dr. Jerry Scott, was called in to support Dr. Lipchenko's request that the Canadians give up their request for 2585 because she had science, back-of-the-envelope science, if you will, non-peer approved by SERS that had 1350 as the new goal. And boy, did my phone ring after that number was tossed out there, because it's nowhere in any document. I mean, you can find 1350 on the chart, but it has nothing to do with the track that we've been on and promised we've been on for a long period of time. And the reason why that's important is we've always been told, and you probably heard this, but when the chairman of SERS is a member of your delegation, he can't even sit in your delegation rooms. It's considered to be unethical to use the chairman of SERS to advocate your country's personal view and position. And that's what Jerry Scott was being used for. I can recall when Joe Powers was chairman of SERS, we were instructed not to talk to him in the hallways. You could wave to him. Don't have breakfast with him. It was just inappropriate to do it. I remember after the mixing report, and he was the chairman, I asked Jerry if he would call him in his room because he wasn't emphasizing the importance of the mixing factor on the heels of a critically important mixing meeting. And Jerry told me, Rich, I can't talk to Jerry right now. He's the chairman of SERS. And here's the head of our delegation taking the chairman of SERS and going into this meeting and doing this very unethical thing. And maybe it was good for those who wanted to see the direction where NOAA was heading, but that sets a precedence. What about when Libya gets the chair of SERS? Are we going to be happy? And how are we going to protest the Libyan chairman using the head of SERS to go around advocating what Libya wants to see for policy in the Mediterranean or the European Community or the Moroccan government, et cetera, et cetera? So I don't know that I've covered all the points I wanted to go through, but I'm obviously deep into this, I'll stop there because there are other members here who I'm sure will catch on to some of the things that I left out. But we were very profoundly, as I said in the note to you, disappointed with the result. It's not the mere 50 tons of 1,800 to 1,750. It's a question of, I had the numbers written down, it's either 550 or 800 metric tons to what the possible yield could have been, rewarding and continuing the rebuilding process, shooting for the star, if you want. A lot of people don't believe that we could ever reach this high recruitment. In fact, we're in the infancy of understanding bluefin tuna. The whole paradigm is changing. People are no longer suggesting, the top-level scientists, Joe Powers, Jean-Marc Fromontaine, is suggesting you stop thinking about one-stock, two-stock, and start thinking about metapopulations and contingents and moving in that direction. There are other spawning grounds. We know that. This life history stuff about, oh, they spawn in the Mediterranean at age 4, but age 14 in the Gulf of Mexico. Nobody believes that. No scientists believe that. It's inadequate science that we're trying to guide this. And I wish I could agree that it's a folly, but there's serious lives and livelihood at stake. And I know you know that and appreciate that as a past member of the industry. And so we're not gonna slow down in our advocacy to follow the science. We're gonna continue to press to follow the science, but the science that's provided by ICAT SCRS, and we're gonna make sure that it's the best science possible. Thanks a lot. Sorry.
I don't think there's anything else to say. Dave?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify one point. The mendacious comment did not refer to science, and I didn't refer to any particular organization. I seriously did not. That comment was in response to the abundance of media reports that came out that said things that were just flatly untrue. There was one particular organization that I've always, it has nothing to do with Rich's organization, that I've always respected, who gave quotes in quotation marks from the SCRS report, and they were fabricated. Identified them as being from the report, and they were fabricated. They were weren't even in the report. And others where they took an actual statement from the report and changed the wording to make it different. That's the kind of mendacity I'm talking about. And that I did not in the report. I didn't refer to Rich. I'm sorry that he took it that way. I didn't mean it that way. I've known Rich for many years, and we haven't always agreed. But he's an honorable man and always has been. as far as the I didn't get into what my personal recommendations were. Because I wanted to give the report of what happened. But I was not in favor of the reduction to 1750. I was in favor of rolling over the 1800 while we figured out what happened in the Gulf after the oil spill to the larval fish, and while the question was clarified as to the recruitment status of the population. The population, the high scenario, low scenario, a low recruitment scenario, Rich is quite right. Neither one of them is absolutely correct. The truth is somewhere in between. And Jerry Scott's recommendation was that since we don't have any clear evidence of where it is, that you take the geometric mean, and that's what was done. But my no matter what happened, the 1,800 ton that we had last year in 2010 would have been adequate to continue an upward building pattern. It would not, under the mixed scenario, get us where we need to be at the time required. But I think there will be other, and I think Rich would agree with me, there are going to be other good recruitment events over the next few years because of the status of the stock right now. So 1,800 I was happy with, and I said this in the delegation meeting, that that 2,000 would not upset me either. So that was where my personal, I didn't bring that into the report, but that was my personal recommendation at the meeting.
Dave?
Yeah, that's
we need to wrap up.
Okay.
But thank you very much for a thorough report. I promised Kristen an opportunity to come to the mic if she wanted to. This is that time.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Kristen Dekus, and I run the Port of New Bedford in Massachusetts. Today we're having a meeting here. We decided to come to you so that we could introduce you to our forum. It's the Mayor's Ocean Fisheries Council. It's a group of folks from industry, from government, from research institutes, and what we'd like to do is just have a nice dynamic discussion with you and share with you some of our perspectives regarding the rulemaking process, regarding the science and research and work that we've been working hard at. Our meeting is going to be in the amphitheater room here at the end of the hall. I hope that you all received your invitation. We do have seats for you. They're all reserved. And I understand on the second floor there's actually a cash bar. I know you've all had a very long day, so if you want to go get a refreshment and then come join us, we'd really appreciate it. We really would like to see you come hear what our group has to say, and I think we could have a very enlightening discussion. Thank you.
All right, we'll see you tomorrow at 8:30.